Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Boston played a major role in the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. It was at Boston University where Dr. King earned his doctorate and learned of Gandhi's teachings of nonviolence through his mentor, former dean of Marsh Chapel, Howard Thurman. This past Monday, Boston University held its annual commemoration of the life and accomplishments of Dr. King. Tonight, we bring you the keynote address from that celebration, delivered by Elaine Jones, retired president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Dean of Students, Kenneth Elmore.
We come here today because we're dealing with our brother, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. I say our brother because he was someone who lived right here in Boston. He was someone who went to school right here at Boston University. He was someone who inspired the nation. And as I heard someone refer to him, he was the leader that rose in a sea of conscience. Now, I would dare to say that if he were alive, let's remember this, he wouldn't be a soundbite today. I don't know if we'd want him around here, actually. But we still have to deal with him, because he's us. He also spoke about history. Many times he said that we are standing in circumstances where we as a people, we as individuals, have to and can deal with history, and that we have to be good at doing that. So a few points of history. 20 years ago, this university decided before a national holiday was to take place that we're going to stop everything that we were going to do and celebrate him, and celebrate his legacy. So I'm glad that this is our 20th. 50 years ago, this year, Dr. King graduated from Boston University. And I'm happy to say that as far as history goes, I'm glad that I, someone who's the son and the grandson of sharecroppers, the great-grandson of slave owners, or I should say slaves. They'd probably prefer to be owning them, but they were slaves. That I could be here today to convene everyone and say, let's remember my brother, Martin Luther King, Jr. So with that, let me also say, as I look around, I see many folks from the community, our students, our faculty, civic leaders, business leaders. Thank you for coming here today. It does us all very proud to get us moving, and I hope we can keep it moving. And by the way, let me say this. If you feel like you got to jump to your feet and holler a little bit, go ahead and do it. You got to dance around, that's all right. A little shout, nothing wrong with it. Like I said, we are not here for a funeral. We're here to be inspired. We're here to think a little bit today and hopefully be a little disturbed as we consider the context of this great man. So let me first introduce our provost. As the provost of this university, Dr. David Campbell is our chief academic officer, which means he's responsible for all programs of an academic nature. Provost at Interim Campbell, who joined the university in 2000, is professor of physics in the College of Arts and Sciences, professor of electrical and computer engineering in the College of Engineering, and he is the dean of the College of Engineering, a very, very busy man. He is going to deliver the official welcome on behalf of the university. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you very much, Dean Elmore. As Ken said, I am David Campbell, the provost at Interim of Boston University. And on behalf of the whole university, I'm delighted to welcome you here to celebrate the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., a figure for the ages and Boston University's most illustrious alumnus. You'll note some commonality between my remarks and Ken's. This is part of our academic philosophy. You tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and you tell them what you told them. So this stuff is all going to be on the quiz, and you better be ready for it. As Ken said, this is the university's 20th annual celebration of the life and accomplishments of a man whose impact on our country and the world cannot be measured fully. A powerful and influential orator, his words gave rise to the civil rights movement and changed policy and attitudes across the United States. His words are as powerful today as they were 50 years ago, and in many cases, as applicable and resounding. His dream lives on. To count this extraordinary individual as a Boston University alumnus is a privilege of which we are extremely and justifiably proud. After growing up and attending public school in Atlanta, Martin Luther King Jr. earned a bachelor's degree from Morehouse College, where even as a sophomore, he had identified his life's mission and wrote in a letter to the editor of the Atlanta Constitution, quote, "We want and are entitled to the basic rights and opportunities of American citizens, the right to earn a living at work for which we are fitted by training and ability, equal opportunities in education, health, recreation, and similar public services, the right to vote, equality before the law, and some of the same courtesy and good manners that we ourselves bring to all human relations." Those are very powerful words and tremendous vision indeed from a 17-year-old. After Morehouse, Dr. King attended Crozier Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, where he earned a Bachelor's of Divinity degree. King then came to Boston University in 1951 to study systematic theology and earned the PhD here in 1955, as Ken pointed out, exactly 50 years ago. He worked here with several mentors, including Edgar Brightman, L. Howard DeWolf, and Howard Thurman, Dean of Marsh Chapel, and the namesake of the room down below that some of you may have seen earlier, each of whom had a tremendous influence in King's study of personalist philosophy. This system, which stresses the sacredness of the person viewed socially, reinforced King's idea that all men are equal and should thus be afforded equal rights. At Boston University, King also explored the philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi and became a proponent of his nonviolent strategy against oppression, something that would become a hallmark of King's leadership in the civil rights movement. As you all know, Dr. King went on to do great things that profoundly affected the social fabric of our nation. He was one of the leaders of the Montgomery bus boycott, founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and led protests in Birmingham, Alabama, that would be a primary catalyst toward the enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. An advocate of nonviolence, Dr. King's words in acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964 resonate especially today. Quote, "I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than evil triumphant. I believe that even amid today's mortar bursts and whining bullets, there is still hope for a brighter tomorrow," unquote. I thank you for attending today's events and hope that this program will present the opportunity for each of us to contemplate the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you.
Thank you, Provost Campbell. Ann Shea is the Vice President for Enrollment and Student Affairs at the university, a big job, which means that she is engaged with making sure that we recruit, that we matriculate, that we enroll, that we support, that we retain the students who come to this university. She has the pleasure of introducing our guest speaker today. Please join me in welcoming Ann Shea. Ann?
I am privileged to introduce our honored guest, Elaine R. Jones, the retired president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, the nation's oldest law firm fighting for equal rights and justice for people of color, women, and the poor. When Ms. Jones took the helm of the Legal Defense Fund in 1993, she became the first woman to head the organization. She brought with her vast experience as a litigator and civil rights activist, as well as a passion for fairness and equality that dates back to her childhood. She retired last year. Born in Norfolk, Virginia, Ms. Jones learned about the realities of racism and the importance of idealism from her mother, a college-educated schoolteacher, and her father, a Pullman porter and a member of the nation's first black trade union. From the age of 8, she knew she wanted to be a lawyer and to commit her life to the pursuit of equal justice. After graduating with honors in political science from Howard University, Elaine joined the Peace Corps and became one of the first African Americans to serve in Turkey. This began a long series of firsts in her career. Following her two-year Peace Corps stint, she became the first black woman to enroll and to graduate from the University of Virginia School of Law. At that time, undergraduate programs at the University of Virginia were not open to either women or to non-whites. It is in that context that Ms. Jones's experience as a first-year law student describes the nature of higher education in her state's flagship institution in 1967. During her first week as a student of law, she was mistaken for a cleaning lady by a secretary who asked her to clean out a refrigerator. Said Jones, recalling that painful reminder of the limits of equality in the America of the 1960s, she saw the color. She didn't notice the books. Ms. Jones was invited to join one of Wall Street's most prestigious firms after her graduation in 1970. She turned it down to pursue the goal she had chosen in her youth and instead joined the LDF staff. With the exception of 2 years as Special Assistant to the United States Secretary of Transportation, she remained with the Legal Defense Fund. She spent the next 14 years in their Washington office litigating and directing LDF's legislative, judicial, and public policy initiatives. In her early years there, Ms. Jones continued to blaze trails, becoming one of the first African-American women to defend death row inmates. Only 2 years out of law school, she was counsel of record in Furman versus Georgia, the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case that abolished the death penalty in 37 states. During this period, she also argued numerous employment discrimination cases, including class actions against some of the nation's largest employers, for instance, the American Tobacco Company, Monsanto, and Pullman Standard. Ms. Jones holds 9 honorary degrees and the highest honor awarded by the University of Virginia, which does not award honorary degrees, the Jefferson Medal of Freedom. She has also received the recognition of many organizations, including the Sarah Lee Foundation, National Newspaper Publishers Association, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, a Lender Foundation, National Association of Black Women Attorneys, and others. We today, in 2005, and at Boston University, where from its founding in 1839, there have never been prohibitions of admission based on race, gender, religion, or ethnic or social heritage, we should pause now to acknowledge the prodigious courage and achievement of this extraordinary woman who is our guest today. In closing, I quote Elaine Jones again. She says, "People call me an optimist, but I have a lot of confidence in the American people. If people have the information, they invariably make the right decision." Her words are affirmation of her character, her hopes for American society, and of the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Elaine Jones, welcome to Boston University.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Vice President Shea, or Ann, if you don't mind my being less formal. It was a very generous, a very gracious introduction. All of the administrators, thank you, Dean, all of the administrators and staff and faculty and students, thank you for coming back. This celebration is a call to conscience for us. It's a call to conscience for us all. I met Dr. King once. Oh, he said, "Oh, Mr. Jones, you met Dr. King. How old might you be?" I said, I'm not telling. Go Google me and find out. But I am not telling. I was a freshman in college, and he came to Howard University and spoke at the Charter Day on March 2nd, 1963. Now, how do I begin to explain to you really how young Martin is? 76. And he gave his life early, very early. Of those 76 years, 37 of them he's been gone. 39 years old. And you look at 76, and you can see why it gets younger and younger for me every day. But, you know, I look at George the Elder, President Bush Sr., what it's called, 41? 41 jumped out of a plane last year at the age of 80. He was, today he's 4 years older than Dr. King had Dr. King lived. He was born June 24th. Then, 6 months later, comes Jimmy Carter, who was 80 last year in October. October 1st, I think. October. He won the Nobel Peace Prize a year ago. When he was 79, he was 3 years older than Dr. King. Then, I mean, if just to get a sense of the sacrifice. Dr. King had children. He had four children, babies. He had a wife. He had obligations to them. Never made much money. Never made much money. It was the call to conscience. Now, I start by saying Dr. King can be called in some sense a reluctant warrior. Reluctant warrior. He didn't try to lead. He did not self-anoint. He didn't view himself as leader. He viewed himself as servant. And so that 1957 boycott, 381 days, the young minister was called to serve the people, and he answered the call. The question that he leaves for us is, when we are called, will we answer? Will we answer? The world has changed since 1957. But the issues are here with us, ladies and gentlemen. They are as real and as poignant and as significant as the issues then. Now, were Dr. King here, he would tell you, I did not serve alone. He would say, I was part of an army. I was part of an army that saw injustice, and we stood up and said, enough. Who served with him? I am going to just call the role of a few who, with Dr. King, made that ultimate sacrifice. It's a long list. And I'm not going to call them all. You can do the research to find out. I mean, you know about the outstanding. You know about, you know, Medgar and Goodman, Cheney, and Schirner. Certain people you know about because the history books discuss them. They're honored in ceremonies and programs. But there are ones you don't know. And I'm just going to name two or three and just give you an idea. I said Martin was called to service.
You know, and Martin started the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1957. Martin was assassinated in 1968. There were 11 years that he was on the front line constantly. But who else was in that army? You remember, one of the most important rights that we have as citizens of these United States is the right to vote. If our votes don't count, and if our votes are suppressed, that goes to the core of this democratic system. Historically, African Americans have had a very difficult time in this country securing and exercising the franchise. That's just a fact of life. That was the Constitution of the United States. The 15th Amendment, we said, well, Miss Jones, you know, that was adopted in 1870. What is the problem? You know, that's 135 years ago. It was in the Constitution. We got the right to vote as African Americans in this country. When the legislature, on the death of John F. Kennedy in 1963 and the ascendancy of Lyndon Baines Johnson to the presidency, understood the importance of passing the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to make the United States the democracy that it claimed to be. Now, there was a struggle leading up to that. Martin had two great speeches, one of which was a call to conscience. After the Selma to Montgomery, the Selma to Montgomery March speech in 1965, he called it a call to conscience about the right to vote. His first major speech on the right to vote was in 1957, entitled "Give Us the Ballot." Give us that. So voting was critical. He understood it. Now, during that struggle, we had African Americans and many whites who understood that struggle, who were coming back from the war, who had come back from World War II and the Korean conflict, vets. These veterans came back from war, fighting for freedom abroad, and went home to Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and Louisiana and said, hey, hey, what is this? With my uniform on. You know, some of these vets would tell you the stories of how they would have prisoners. The prisoners. German, Japanese prisoners. And the prisoners could eat, and they couldn't. I mean, it was unconscionable. But you had a new movement beginning. And these veterans and these ministers and others stood on the front line. And let me give you a couple of examples. Reverend George Lee, in 1955, 10 years before the civil rights workers launched a massive campaign to register black voters in Mississippi, Reverend Lee formed a chapter of the NAACP in Belzoni, Mississippi, to urge blacks to pay the required poll tax and register to vote. White citizens in town responded by organizing a chapter of the White Citizens Council, engaged in various intimidation techniques, and denied blacks who registered credit or raised their rent. After registering nearly 100 black voters in 1 year, Lee began receiving death threats. His widow remembers begging him to slow down his work, to which he replied, "Somebody has to lead." In May 1955, on the day before Mother's Day, Lee was driving home when a passenger in a passing car opened gunfire. He was taken to the hospital with his face nearly blown apart, where he later died from the attack. The sheriff refused to investigate the killing. The coroner ignored the evidence and ruled that Lee died from unknown causes. Lamar Smith, 3 months later, was killed for leading registration efforts for black voters in Brookhaven, Mississippi. Smith, a 63-year-old veteran of World War II, prominent farmer in the town, organized black voters, helped organize absentee ballot drives, and even campaigned for candidates he judged to be fair. August 13, 1955, 10 days after he cast his vote against a candidate, who was a bigoted county supervisor, Smith was shot in broad daylight on the front lawn of the county courthouse. A number of witnesses, the sheriff was close enough to hear the gunshot. No one was willing to testify against the three men who were later arrested for the murder, and they were acquitted of all charges. Herbert Lee, 1961, he began working with Bob Moses and SNCC, the Southern Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in 1961. For many months, Lee drove the local NAACP president all over Mississippi as they attempted to encourage blacks to register to vote. That was rising violence. The Justice Department came to town. The morning after the Justice Department returned to Washington, Lee was delivering a truckload of cotton when a Mississippi state representative approached Lee shouting. When Lee got out of the truck, the representative took a gun and shot Lee in the head, killing him instantly. I mean, there's a long list. Reverend James Reeb, a white Unitarian minister from Washington, D.C., flew to Montgomery, Alabama in March of 1965 to participate in the Selma Voting Rights March, the one that Martin helped lead. Before the march began, Reverend Reeb and two friends got lost in downtown Selma and ended up at the local all-white club, the Silver Moon Cafe. Before they entered the cafe, Reeb and his group of friends were attacked by a group of white men. During the scuffle, Reeb was hit in the head with a heavy club, died 2 days later from a massive skull fracture. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the environment. White female, Viola Luiso, you know about Viola, white mother from Detroit, drove to Alabama to assist with the Montgomery March after she had seen the attacks on the voting rights workers and she heard of the death of Reverend Reeb. Her job was to transport workers between the towns. When driving a male African-American worker from Selma to Montgomery, she was targeted by the Klan, who saw her leave Selma with a black passenger. As they drove after her, she noticed she was being followed, but was unable to get away before the Klansman drove up beside her and shot her in the head. She was killed instantly. I'm saying this was a major war. This was, you talk about terrorism. This was terrorism domestic style here in the United States. The last one I want to mention is Vernon Dahmer. Vernon was extraordinary. Man, he was. Now, Vernon was very, very fair. He didn't have to be black, if you know, get my drift. Vernon, you know, he really, no one would have known that he was a black man unless he announced it. He did announce it. And he lived as a black man in Mississippi. And he owned a large farm, a sawmill and a grocery store just north of Hattiesburg. He was the father of 8 children. He was also president of the local NAACP and notorious for urging people to vote. The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. This is 1966. That still was a poll tax. In January 66, he began collecting the poll taxes for his neighbors. He even paid some of the poll taxes. That evening, in January 1966, Dahmer's home was attacked with firebombs. While his family escaped out the back, Dahmer began shooting the Klansmen from his front doorway. He died shortly afterwards from severe burns suffered in the attack. Right now, if you go to Hattiesburg and go to Vernon Dahmer's grave, there is his tombstone, which reads, "If you don't vote, you don't count." I mean, these are Martin's soldiers, those who labored with him. These are the people who understood it was a war, and who have passed on that torch, who have passed that baton on to us. Votes do count. Votes do matter. Now, it's interesting the role that lawyers play. Why law school, Elaine? You know, law school. Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American on the Supreme Court of the United States, was the head of the organization I was privileged to head, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, an organization separate from the NAACP. The Legal Defense Fund came into existence. Thurgood wrote our charter in his own handwriting, and we've been in existence for 65 years, since 1940, completely separate from the NAACP, and while I was head of it, people had to understand that, because that's money that had to be raised every year. I couldn't raise it if people were confused. But the point that Thurgood made when Martin was doing all of the marching and having the kids and the out front and the dogs and the water hoses. So the story goes that Thurgood said to Martin, "Why, I don't approve of these tactics. I mean, I really don't. Putting our children in harm's way, being out there on the firing line like that, you put women and children, you know, could face injury." And Martin responded, "You know, this is a massive nonviolent peaceful movement. Anyone who's a part of it is a part of it because they want to be part of it, not because there's any mandate." And he said, "Thurgood, according as the story goes, you are one of the country's finest lawyers. I'm going to do what I have to do, and I want you to do what you do best. Be the lawyer and come down and get us out of jail. That's your obligation." Thurgood took that seriously. And throughout the 60s, that's what the Legal Defense Fund did, represent all of the Freedom Riders, brought all of that litigation, went up to the Supreme Court, lived in the Supreme Court of the United States in case after case after case, trying to make the equal justice under law a reality for all people denied those rights. Now, also, Martin's approach to social justice and civil rights was all-inclusive. Civil rights aren't just for Latinos, aren't just for African Americans, aren't just for Asian Americans. They also are for whites and everybody else in this country. We all have basic fundamental rights that have to be fought for. When I took Thurgood's position and was lucky enough to be appointed, one of the cases we had was for white male who came, middle-aged white male, came to the office. Indeed, he was a regional manager at a company. And he had been told, "You have too many blacks in this operation. You're just hiring too many." And he responded, "I'm hiring the people who come through the door who have the qualifications." He insisted on doing the right thing. After a while, he was fired because he didn't change the racial composition of his workforce. When he was fired, he found my office. When he came into that office, I sat him down and found two lawyers, not one, but two lawyers. Because you want to make sure that someone like that, who understands the rule of law, the law has to protect him. He shouldn't lose his job because he's acting according to law. So we represented him. And I'm happy to say that at the end of that representation, he never had to work anywhere else ever again. And it's on a boat somewhere down in Florida. But that, so it does encompass us all. LDF, one of the first cases that not only did we represent Martin, but one of the first cases we had in the Supreme Court of the United States was employment discrimination on behalf of women. White female, from Martin Marietta, her last name will come to me, from Martin Marietta. First case in the Supreme Court, she had three preschool-age kids. went to Mark Marietta down in Atlanta for a job. And she told him she wanted a job. They said, well, yes, you're qualified for an entry-level position, but we think you should be at home because you have three preschool-age kids. Now, that was real. That was nothing prohibiting that. Nothing prohibiting that in the early 70s. So the question was, is there a law that protected her? And so Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1965 had been passed. LDF took Ida Mae Phillips. LDF took Ms. Phillips's case and went up to the Supreme Court of the United States, and Supreme Court of the United States said she was protected. Martin Marietta, your job is to hire her. So these are the kinds of issues. This is Martin's message for us to see where we are in our time. What are the issues that with we are faced? Now, I am going to share with you three issues that are critical in our time. This issue of education, ladies and gentlemen, this issue of early childhood, elementary and secondary education, that is nothing more important. And we are dropping the ball. We are not serving our children, all of our children, well. We're not. Some we are. Too many we are not. And Brown versus Board of Education, the case that broke the back of apartheid in America in 1954, was in the realm of public education, was in the context of public education. But we have dawdled. We can't spend the next 50 years the way we've spent the last 50. We have wasted time arguing and isolating school districts and not funding sources. I have never had a child. I would not know how to vote against a bond issue for school construction. I just would not know how to not punch that Chad on that ballot. I just wouldn't know how to do it. That our nation and our future depends on the education of all of our children. This is race and gender, all of that's important, but it's beyond that. It's about our success as a nation. China, 1.3 billion people, has just announced a program, a 20-year program, to make sure that each and every child gets a quality education. Each and every child. And it should be fully in place and operational within the next 20 years. They're already ahead of us on in math and in science. Already. And we are still wasting time. And I don't know what gets in our way as a nation of not tapping into the brain power of all of our kids. And we have got to figure out what's stopping us from doing it. What's stopping us? We know it's not being done. And people say, oh, Elaine, we need private schools. Let me tell you. Most millionaires, people who have serious money in America, many of them, not most, many, have their kids in public schools. But they're public schools that they control. The public schools in the school district in that they control, and they have to put in the resources in, they monitor, they do all the things that you have to do to make sure a child learns. To make sure a child learns. And I'm saying we want the same thing for all of our children that they have for their children. Because some kids cannot carry the burden of the entire nation. And if we want to have a nation that has the economic resources and the wherewithal, rather than continue to be a debtor nation and putting folk in prison and paying $45 billion a year in a prison system. Throwing away money is what we're doing for nonviolent offenders. $45 billion a year. We incarcerate more people than China. I mean, and so we have a problem there, and that has to be resolved. That's a problem for your generation. Figure that out. Straighten it. We did not inherit this prison industrial complex. Our grandparents, your great-grandparents, my grandparents did not give us this system. This is a system that we have developed since 1986. And just like we've developed it, we can dismantle it. All right, now, I'm going to leave you with one, with education, the prison industrial complex. But the third one is an issue that's not on anybody's radar screen. It's not on anybody's radar screen. But it's an issue of simple justice. I talked about the ballot and Martin's lifelong struggle for the ballot. We have a jurisdiction in the United States that pays $2 billion a year in federal taxes. $2 billion. I'm a resident of that district. We have that same district that sends folks off the wall who come back, if they come back, with injuries and psychological and physical injuries that have to be dealt with. We have a jurisdiction that has 573,000 residents that has no vote. The District of Columbia, the D.C. residents have no vote. We are in Afghanistan. We are in Iraq talking about elections. And here at home, it's the only, we pay taxes. We pay taxes. It's a different thing if you didn't have the tax burden. I just had to send, I don't have it, I just had to send Uncle Sam $20,000 in estimated taxes. Estimated income I don't even have. He wants his taxes when he wants it, not when you want. To not to give the District of Columbia voting representation in the Congress of the United States in 2004 is as unjust and as unfair as we can be as a people. And the district can't get it alone. It can only get it if people outside the district take the time, do the research, understand the constitutional issues, the papers have been written, get involved, and use your influence to make sure that they have voting representation in the House and the Senate. They don't have to be a state to have voting representation. The Supreme Court has made it clear Congress can do what it wants to do. Congress can, you know, pass the buck. Congress can do it. But if Congress doesn't have the will to do it, because what does it mean? It means two more senators in the U.S. Senate. It also means a voting delegate in the House. We've got a delegate in the House. We can go to the polls and vote for a delegate. We can vote for the President of the United States. But the delegate then has no vote. The delegate had Eleanor Holmes Norton. The Congress lady from District of Columbia has no vote in the Congress. Now, that's wrong. And that's something we need to straighten out. District can't do it alone. And it's going to take this country being informed, doing its homework, understanding the issues, standing up and said, we want to get this wrong. We want to make this wrong right. I want to end with, It's a quote that I love. And if I can find it among my notes to which I have not referred. All right. Just a couple of quick things on the prison population. We've got 2 million people behind bars. Now, understand me. I'm not talking about the people who rob us, rape us, maim us. I'm not talking about the physical, those who do physical violence to us. Ms. Jones's head is not that woolly. That's not what I'm discussing. I am talking about non-violent offenders who in the rest of the world are treated as if they have medical problems. Someone who's not pushing or selling drugs, who's leaning up against the wall nodding, why do we give that person 25 years without the possibility of parole? Paying $25,000 a year for them in general population. Every year we incarcerate them. They contribute nothing. Are able to contribute nothing to society. Now, that's self-defeating. And that's what we're doing. The burden of incarcerating these folks is becoming so great on the states that the states are beginning to change some of these policies. It's three times you're out stuff, and three times you're out. You know, they're beginning to change because they can't afford it. It's too expensive. But we need to change the public policy. With 2 million people behind bars, it's like the combined populations of Atlanta, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Des Moines, and Miami. That's the 2 million people. Also, if you look at the United States, the California alone has incarcerated more people than France, Great Britain, Germany, Japan, Singapore, and the Netherlands combined. It's out of control. We need to change it. So I just thought I'd come by. If Martin were coming through the door, he would say, yes, these are the issues of your time. And there are additional ones. I haven't talked about health care. I haven't talked about what's happening to women in these prisons. These women haven't done anything but falling in love, L-U-B, with somebody, and gone to the post office or made a delivery. They didn't even know what was in the package. And so when the prosecutor is charging them, what do they get? Johnny, who they're in love with can get a 6-year sentence, a reduced sentence, because he could give up somebody in the chain ahead of him. Who can she give up? Johnny. They already have Johnny. So she ends up with a 20-year sentence without possibility of parole. And that's what you find. That's who Martha Stewart is seeing up there. That's why you sit on the website. She's up there. That's who she's seeing. You know, and that is something that we need. The average woman in prison has a couple of kids. It's time for us to get these policies changed. Here's my quote. Reinhold Niebuhr, and it should be Howard Thurman. I understand that. Thurman Center. I understand that. But Reinhold Niebuhr, Union Theological Seminary. Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in one lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. He goes on and say, nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Then he ends with, nothing that we can do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, in the final analysis, we are saved by love. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. We gave Ms. Jones a commemorative poster the very first time we've celebrated Dr. King's birthday here on the campus. Thank you. Blessed community is a term that you will see that Dr. King used many times. I had a chance to read up a little bit and found out that Josiah Royce actually was the first one to use the term. He was someone who founded the Fellowship of Reconciliation, to which Dr. King was a member. And Dr. King, I think, did more to popularize the term. You all know that he did much to try and get us to live a nonviolent life, to try and make sure we lived our lives in a way that would recognize common humanity. And the end result, he thought, would be something called beloved community. With that, I wanted to ask Reverend Ego Ezidi to join us to give a message, a blessing to the beloved community that we have here and those that join us. The Reverend Ezidi is a pastor, associate pastor at the Morningside Baptist Church, and he also is right here with us as director of external affairs at our university's medical campus. Come on up, sir.
Truly, I am honored to be here for this most auspicious occasion as we celebrate the life and times of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., my fellow yoke person in the preaching of the the gospel. I stand here today as a beneficiary, if you will, of the hard work, the blood, the sweat, and the tears of those who came before me. Do not look at me and be misled, for I realize that men and women in the past have died so that I might be able to enjoy my way of life. Dr. King said this. He said, "All that evil needs to prevail is for good people to stand back and do nothing." I don't know about you today, but I heard Mrs. Jones. I heard what she was saying. And she's saying that we cannot settle. We cannot just sit back and think that times are going to take care of themselves, but we must do something about it. And we must make a stand. We have a lot of hard work ahead of us, but together we will do it. Bless you.
The Reverend Ego Azidi delivering the blessing at Boston University's annual commemoration of the life and accomplishments of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Earlier, we heard from the keynote speaker, Elaine Jones, retired president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Ann Shea, Boston University Vice President for Enrollment and Student Affairs. University Provost, Dr. David Campbell. And Dean of Students, Kenneth Elmore. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Spogue and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.